Now, there's a prophecy in the book of Jeremiah stating that the captivity would last 70 years. It seems to be perfectly clear, but it involves a difficulty. Where do you start counting the 70 from? And probably this is to be counted from 605 B.C. when the first Jewish people were taken away from Jerusalem. Now, these people taken on four occasions by Nebuchadnezzar and his army, 605, 597, 586, 581. And on returning, the first party returned 536, and then there were other returns after that. All this outlined in your book. Now, I think you should realize that this was a terrible hardship for these people. To be forced out of their homes and lose everything and only keep the clothes they were wearing and what they could toss together in a little pillowcase or something and toss it over their shoulder, and have to march 600 or 700 miles across wild country, driven by a conquering army of soldiers, and the butt of ridicule and attacked by robbers and so on. This was terribly hard on people. However, after they got to Babylon, they were not mostly badly treated, although they were the object of some ridicule. But most of these people never saw the city of Babylon. They were put in remote parts of Babylonia. And Daniel, of course, did. He lived in Babylon. He was important. But most of these people never got to see that wonder city of the ancient world. So there they were, far from home, the expelled and displaced population of a defeated and conquered country. Now, they were not, however, badly treated, except they had to stay there. And after a while, they began to get on their feet economically and began to find out that there are better ways to get ahead in life than raising barley. Palestine, the economy had been exclusively agricultural, and it isn't very good. They had to work very hard from sunrise to sunset just to get along. They're like the cross-country runner who said, I have to run just as fast as I can to stay where I am. And life was very hard, and they just barely could make it by hard work. Now, in Babylonia, they were not doing farming, and some of them became storekeepers and merchants and shopkeepers, and the Jewish people found out, maybe for the first time in their history, that they had a certain aptitude for banking and handling money. Is this true to life? Well, I guess it is. And some of them became very rich and started local branches of Household Finance Corporation, you know, or something like this, and began to accumulate money. And most of them got on their feet financially fairly well. Some were still poor, but they were doing much better than they had before. Now, this was a very bitter pill for these people to swallow, and yet good came of it. And I'll try to point out to you and clear some of the good that came out of the Babylonian captivity. Now, God had been trying to teach these people a lesson, and he worked on it 1,000 years. From the time of Moses to the time of Daniel. Moses 1500 B.C., Daniel 500 B.C. That's 1,000 years, just about, around numbers. That there is only one God and all the others are false. Idolatry and polytheism are false religions, and only the Lord is God. And this they were slow to learn and quick to unlearn. And God had been working on them with his Spirit and by his prophets for all those centuries, and still they hadn't learned it. C.S. Lewis, in one of his books, says, I think in The Problem of Pain, I think that was the book, God speaks to people in three ways. Conscience is God's whisper, Scripture is God's voice, and calamity is God's shout. And when people are deaf to the whisper, And I'm willing to listen to the voice. Sometimes God, not because he hates them, but because he loves them, flags them down with calamity. So that the person who meets with this finally has to face moral reality and can no longer kid himself that everything is fine when everything is not fine, and has to step out from living in a world of moral illusion into the world of things as they really are. Now, the Babylonian captivity did that for the Jews. When they came back from this, they were cured of idolatry once and for all. The lesson was learned and never had to be repeated. From that day to this, to be a Jew is to be a hater of idols, the most consistent monotheist that you could possibly imagine. They learned it from calamity, the Babylonian captivity. Now, that is one game. The emphasis of the Bible at this point shifts to something new. This lesson had been learned, you see. Didn't have to keep on harping on this anymore. I admit, as we've traced it through in this course in Bible 101, it's almost monotonous. The endless campaign against idolatry and high places and Baal and all that business. But you see, it had to be repeated and repeated because they hadn't learned it yet. Now, they have learned it now. And from here on, the emphasis in the Old Testament and the center of interest and attention is the coming of Christ, the promise and prophecy of a Messiah or a Savior who would save them and save the world. And this becomes increasingly the center of attention in the spotlight of the Old Testament. And of course, when you come down to the New, all the spotlight beams are focused on one person there, and that's Jesus Christ, the fulfillment of all this hope and promise. Now, this is a gain from the Babylonian captivity. Another gain that the Jews made was the origin of the synagogue. Now, any of you ever been in a synagogue? All right, it looked like a church inside, more or less. In this country, at least, the synagogue you might not even know hardly that you were in a building of the Jewish faith. Very similar to what we would consider like finding a church. You know, pews to sit in, the pulpit and Bible and so forth. Now, the origin of the synagogue is obscure. The word synagogue comes from a Greek word, synagoge, which means simply assembly. And just like our word church, it's ambiguously used. It may be used to mean the building, or it may be used to mean the body of people that meet there, the congregation. We talk about a church properly, it's the people that make the church. But then we also speak about the church at the corner of 4th Avenue and 31st Street or something like that, and speak about the building. Now, synagogue was like that. When this originated is unknown, really. They're not mentioned at all in the early part of the Old Testament and barely in the later part. In the New Testament, there are synagogues everywhere. The rule for a synagogue was they have to be 10 heads of families, or in other words, 10 families, to make a synagogue. If they had less than this, they could have a fellowship group, but it was not organized and didn't rate as a real synagogue. And that's the rule today, and it was in the New Testament. Now, in the New Testament, you find them everywhere. Every little tiny village that had a few Jewish families would have a synagogue. And large places like Jerusalem would have 20 or 30 maybe. Just like in America, you might find a small village that would have one church, but the large city has many. And later they began to spring up outside of Palestine in places to which the Jewish people went. Now, you know, the Babylonian captivity was forced. They didn't have any option. They had to go. But after this was over, they began to go places voluntarily for business reasons. And so there sprang up colonies of Jewish people all around the port cities and shores of the Mediterranean Sea. Alexandria, Egypt, in the time of the New Testament, was the second largest city in the Roman Empire. Rome was the largest, Alexandria the second, and Antioch the third. One quarter of Alexandria was Jewish. It is estimated that in the time of Christ and the apostles, there were 750,000 Jews in Alexandria, and other places less, but still a large number. And where they went, they took some things with them that changed the ancient world. Now, you should realize, first of all, what the prevailing mood was of the ancient world at the time when the Jews began to move out into it, and later Christianity moved in. This is a prelude to Christianity here, this migration of the Jews outside of their own country, voluntarily and chiefly for commercial reasons, but it had byproducts. Now, that ancient world was a world in which the prevailing mood was pessimism, on the verge of downright utter despair. At least half the people were slaves. The average lifespan was somewhere in the 20s. Life was cheap, and cruelty was everywhere. It was a very hard, dark, and almost hopeless world. Now, you can't live without hope. You aren't really alive anymore when hope has died in you. It's just a matter of time till you're physically dead, if you've actually lost hope. And here was a world that had almost lost hope. Also, a world in which evil was almost dominant. Here's a papyrus letter discovered in Egypt from the Greek period, 200 before Christ, maybe. Just about the time we're talking about here. This was written by an Egypto-Roman official. He's a Roman official serving in Egypt, to his wife. She's at home. He's away from home on a business trip. He's expecting the birth of a baby. And he writes this letter in Greek to his wife, filled with the most loving and endearing language, first page or so of it. Then he comes down to the real point. When the baby is born, if it is a boy, save it alive. If it is a girl, take it out by the roadside and abandon it. And then some more of the affectionate and loving language. Now, this kind of thing wasn't even considered a sin or a moral problem, except by the Jews in the Roman Empire. This girl baby that is abandoned by the roadside will either die, or if picked up by somebody, will be raised to be a slave or a prostitute. That's the kind of a world it was. Matthew Arnold, the English essayist and poet of about 1890 to 1910, I guess he was writing this thing. Not exactly a cubby either, but poets often, they catch the mood of things, and it isn't always their own real belief. He pictures the kind of a world that the Jewish faith and later the Christian faith entered into, a dark world. And I'll give you a quote. I can only quote one stanza. I spent a lot of time finding this on the library. Matthew Arnold pictures the kind of a world. A member of the Roman Senate, a Roman nobleman in Rome, this man, as it may, he's got all kinds of money. He lives in a marble mansion. He has about 24 slaves to wait on him. He's a member of the Senate. He's got rank and status and friends and money and all these things. But is deeply unhappy and bored and wearied by life. He's not a slave. He's a slave owner. But he's wearied by life. And Arnold pictures this. On that hard pagan world, disgust and secret loathing fell. Deep weariness and sated lust made human life a hell. In his cool hall with haggard eyes, the Roman noble lay. He rode abroad in furious guise along the Appian Way. He paid a feast, drank fierce and fast, and crowned his head with flowers. No easier, nor no quicker, passed the impracticable hours. weariness of life. That's the mood. Pessimism, a pessimistic lifestyle and worldview, and despair. And skepticism in religion. The old religions had run their course, and nobody but the most ignorant people believed in them anymore. And what the philosophers had to put in place of those was sawdust. You could be an Epicurean and say, we're in this world to live for pleasure. And in the end, it ends up like Matthew Arnold's poem, Secret Loathing. Or you could be a Stoic like the present-day existentialist and say, buck up and hold your chin up. Life is a tragedy. That's what it is. There is no meaning to it. You can just keep your courage up and make the best of it. Both of those terribly unsatisfactory creeds. F.F. Bruce wrote a book called The Spreading Flame on Early Christianity. The first chapter was entitled A Light Shone in the Darkness. The second chapter, titled The Darkness Did Not Put It Out. Now, the Jewish faith was a light shining in the darkness, and the darkness didn't put it out. And it got the world ready for the coming a little bit later of the Christian faith. Now, what did the Jewish faith bring? In the first place, these Jews who went to Marseille, France, or Alexandria, Egypt, or Corinth, or Rome, wherever they're going to, they go there because they have to have a way of living and earning money and so forth to support their families. But they take with them their Bible and their synagogue. And this began to make a real impression in the world of that day, because it met needs that people couldn't ignore. Now, the Bible, of course, in Palestine was in Hebrew. But these people moving to France and Spain and Italy and so forth, pretty soon the ones that could read Hebrew all died off. And their children couldn't read it. They read Greek or Latin, and so there was a demand for the Bible in a language that people could read, and this produced the Septuagint, or LXX, the Greek translation of the Old Testament. This became very influential. This brought with it, first of all, belief, a reasonable belief in one God, over against the mythology of Homer's Odyssey, for example. A reasonable belief in one God. Secondly, it brought with it a clean and high moral code in a world that did not have one. That example of abandoning the girl baby to die is just one sample of the dark, immoral practices of that world into which the Jewish faith brought a beacon light. Here's the Ten Commandments, the real meaning of which is love God and love your fellow man. And then it spells it out, what this involves. You don't kill him if you love him, you know. And so on. This challenged the more serious-minded Greek and Roman. Here's something they hadn't had before. A moral code that really sets a valid ideal in front of people. Then it also brought a reasonable and bright hope of a life beyond death. Now the human heart hungers for this. People who say they believe death ends at all, they don't really believe death ends at all. And death doesn't end at all. And the heart hungers for the hope of immortality. We were made that way. And the Jewish faith brought this. Death is not the end. People were created in the image of God to live forever. An elderly man had been sick some in the church where I attend a good deal of time on Darlington Road, said to me, I said, how are you? Oh, I don't expect to live very long. I said, Mr. So-and-so, you are a Christian and you're going to live forever. Well, I guess that's right. We forget that, you know. I said, you're a Christian and you were created to live forever. This is only the first chapter of the book that we're going through here and getting educated for. Just the first chapter. We're in the kindergarten of God's school in this world. Now, hope of life beyond death. Where this faith was taken seriously, it produced an optimistic worldview over against the prevailing pessimistic worldview. Here is an optimistic lifestyle and worldview, and this was accompanied by, let's say, a kind of hard-working, thrifty, serious-minded and successful living accompanied by a fear of God and compassion on the sufferings of your fellow men. Now, the Jewish faith brought this, and Christianity picked it up where the Jewish faith left it off. But this probably never would have happened if it hadn't have been for the Babylonian captivity. Now, about the synagogue, we mentioned a little bit ago, anywhere except in the very smallest villages, the synagogue would have attached to it two other features, a library and a common school, so that this became not only a place of worship, but it became a social and cultural and educational center. And so here is a whole new kind of living growing up around the synagogue and centered in it that involves the whole human personality, social and intellectual and so forth, as well as religious. And this was introduced by the Jews. Now, I want to go back a little bit here before we time runs out on us. The trip back from Babylon. Who was the king that turned the green light on for these people to go home? Well, Cyrus the Persian. Now, prophesied in Isaiah 44 and 45, Cyrus. Cyrus seems to have been a bit of a public relations man. What he said depended a little bit on who he was talking to. He said to the people of Babylon that as he was marching to capture Babylon, Marduk, the chief god of Babylon, marched at his side, right in step with him. Nobody else saw Marduk, but Cyrus said he did. And he told this to the Babylonians. Marduk, their chief god, was right with him on this trip. He tried to tell every country what he thought they'd like to hear. This is how to win friends and influence people on the ancient Medes and Persian scale. And to the Jews, he said that the God of heaven had commanded him to build a temple for his worship in Jerusalem. Well, this pleased the Jews. And to all these displaced populations, he said, you can go back if you want to your home country. Now, the Jews weren't the only ones. There were maybe two dozen other nations that had been deported away from their home. And now they're allowed to go back. The ancient Persians apparently worked on the general idea that people are more likely to love you if you're nice to them. I wonder, Ms. Hudson, you think that's true? You win friends and influence people by kicking them and sitting on their head? Well, of course not. And the Babylonians and the Assyrians had kicked people and sat on their head. I heard a quote from a Japanese military officer before World War II. He said, the Koreans are going to love Japan. That had destroyed their freedom, their independence. No, the Koreans are going to love Japan. And if they don't, we will shoot them until they do. And I heard of a fellow, not a Geneva student, I'm glad to say, that said to his girlfriend, I love you so much, I have to shoot you. And he did. Well, this kind of love we can do without. And the Persians had a better view of things. They figured that people will love you if you're kind to them. And there was an element of decency and civilization and compassion and human kindness in the way the Persians treated conquered peoples, including the Jews. Now the Persians got over it after a couple hundred years. They got Edmund Burke, I believe it was. No, William? Yeah, Edmund Burke in British Parliament said, power corrupts and absolute power corrupts absolutely. I was going to quote William Penn. He said, men will be ruled by God or they will be ruled by tyrants. But power corrupts. The Persians got cruel too. But to start with, they were not. And so all these displaced people could go back if they wanted to, but nobody had to. Now this meant that the ones that did choose, let's say of the Jews, to make the trip to Jerusalem were a select group. The ones that were complacent and enjoying their newfound luxury in Babylon and their money and getting ahead financially would hesitate to pull up stakes and move, and it would be expensive and dangerous. So they would stay in Babylon as they were allowed to do. But the ones to whom their religious ideal was all important, who lived for this, they would endure the hardships and make the sacrifices and undertake the difficult and dangerous journey. Now, they would journey, and most of them on foot. You see, this was an automatically selected group. They were the cream of the crop, and God had a good bunch to start with here to, let's say, carry on from this point in getting ready for the coming of Jesus Christ. These are the ones that have made the commitment. Unless the worldly-minded and the nominal religionists behind in Babylon. Now, they had to go on foot, except for probably a few real old people and some very small children who would ride maybe, but the rest would march. And this meant they couldn't go very fast, several hundred miles. They would walk or march until the middle of the afternoon and stop and build campfires and fix a meal and eat it and sit around the fires and talk and sing and visit until everybody got sleepy and then go to sleep and try again the next day. And during these campfire sessions, you can imagine this. The Bible doesn't tell it all, but it must have happened like this. The scattered few old people that had been in Jerusalem before would tell the younger people what Jerusalem was like. And you see, these returnees are not the same people that had been taken away. They're their grandchildren. It's just 50 to 70 years have gone by. And so there's only a scattered minority among this great crowd of people that have ever been in Jerusalem before. Most of these people have been born in Babylon. And these younger people, they have no way of knowing what Jerusalem is like, except by hearing the older people talk about it. Now I wonder, Mr. Wenger, do people, when they get older than your age and mine combined, become nostalgic about the good old days? Sure, you've got grandparents, any of you, you ask them what they think of the school system of America when they were kids, the Little Red Schoolhouse. This was supposed to be education at its best. You know, one teacher in a one-room school teaching 8 grades, reading and writing and arithmetic, taught to the tune of a hickory stick, education at its best. Who would want to go back to that today? But when people get old, they forget the hardships and the bitter experiences, and they think back through a nostalgic, romanticized haze to the good old days of their childhood and youth. And don't laugh at all the old folks like Dr. Wing and me. If God spares you, you'll get that way too someday. Now, the older folks would build up this image of Jerusalem. You ought to see Jerusalem, the city of God. This is the most beautiful place. And Solomon's temple is nothing like it. The gold and ivory say it is beautiful. And they would tell this to the younger people and feed them this line. And the younger people had nothing to check this by. Got to take their word for it. And finally they get there. You get over the last little range of hills and another half day and they're in the city. Boy, oh boy, what a letdown. This dirty dump. This slum. Is this the city of God you've been telling us about all this time? It's a wonder they didn't lose their religion right there. After all that buildup, you know, here's Jerusalem in ashes and ruins. The temple of God, pile of rubble and weeds. The king's palace, ashes and broken bricks and weeds. And everything, the city wall and all buildings destroyed and burned. And here, people have put up makeshift cabins, just helter-skelter, here and there, without any plan or order, just makeshift for a place to live. And these people come back from Babylon. Dear me, this is worse than what we lived in Babylon. This is the city of God. And it was simply overwhelming. Now, nobody in those 50 years since the city was destroyed had had the authority or the money or the spirit or gumption to rebuild it or do anything about it. So these people were faced with an overwhelming problem. They started with rebuilding the temple of God. This took 20 years. Now, it wouldn't have taken more than 1 year, but their enemies stalled it by accusing them to the king of Persia of disloyalty, and repeatedly there came orders to stop building that temple. And they finally got it cleared and got it built, but it took them 20 years, 536 to 516. And finally it was dedicated, the second temple, which was replacing Solomon's temple that had been destroyed. And the few really old people that had once seen Solomon's temple before it was destroyed, they stand there at the dedication of the second temple and cry tears. This isn't as good as what we had before. Best we can do, but this isn't that one. And the younger people that had never seen Solomon's temple, they cry tears of joy. They think this new one is just wonderful. And so the joy and the sadness are mingled here. Now, all around the Jews, when they were taken away to be captured, there were the Edomites and the Moabites and the Ammonites and the Philistines and so forth, who wanted their land. And they couldn't think of anything nicer than for Nebuchadnezzar to tote the Jews away. Lovely. The Babylonians taking the Jews captive to the other side of the Euphrates River. There's nothing we'd rather have happen. Now I can have that nice grape vineyard that I always wanted, and that orchard with the olive and fig trees in it. The Edomites, descended from Esau, Jacob's brother, or partly descended from him, came in and formed a cheering section while the Babylonian soldiers smashed the fine carved woodwork of Solomon's temple and tore the building down and burned it, and the Edomites cheered. And let me tell you, the Jews never forgot that, and they haven't forgotten it today, that the Edomites came in and cheered and applauded while the Babylonians were doing this terrible work of destruction. Part of the Arabs today in Jordan are descended from the Edomites, and this is the old Jacob-Esau feud still sort of fizzling over there at this present day. Now, the Jews majored in two things. One was relativity, whom I related to, and the other was land title. What land do I own? Remember Naboth wouldn't sell his vineyard to Ahab because it was his inheritance from his forefathers. They used to go over and over who owns what in the way of land and keep that land in the family that it belonged to century after century as an inheritance. Now, in Babylon, they've lost their land, but they haven't forgotten it. And they know who owns what. If they didn't have maps of it, they've got it all in their head. Who owns what, and they're going to come back to it and claim it again. So finally, they come back. Now, these people that wanted their land have moved in and taken it by squatters' rights all over the place. Suddenly, they said, the Jews, they're never coming back. They've gone through the other side of the Euphrates River. We'll never see them again. This is ours now. Then, finally, they hear. Babylon has fallen. Oh, that's not so good. Cyrus the Persian is king. That's not so good either. Then a little later, a decree has been made permitting the Jews to return home. Say, that's just awful. And then finally, the Jews are on the march. And then one day, the Jews arrive around Jerusalem. This is my farm. Like fun it is. We've had it for 50 years by squatter's rights. Doesn't make any difference. It's my property. I got it from my forefathers. So there were just endless disputes about the ownership of land. Finally settled, but took a long time to do. And this resulted in these people who had moved in and taken what didn't really belong to them at all, being very nasty to the Jews and very irritating and with a chip-on-the-shoulder attitude and frustrating and objecting to everything. Since when Nehemiah came to rebuild the wall, they tried to block this every way they possibly could. Now, why was it necessary for the Jews to come back from Babylon? It was prophesied that the Savior of the world would be born in Bethlehem of Judea. And that prophecy still stood. And if the Jewish people stayed in Babylon, all of them, this couldn't be fulfilled. So that was one reason for it. All right, let's stop there.